Hello and welcome to the Happy Hour. I'm your host, Tony Yang, and with me are my usual compatriots, Alex Cortez and Clark Price. How are you two gentlemen doing?
Doing okay. Hello, yeah. Everyone. Good to see you, hear from you again.
Yeah, it's been a couple of weeks for you, Alex. We're out at the, I guess, Dodgers game or something. Is that right?
Yeah. It's okay. They still finished in second place behind my Giants by a game. I'm okay with that.
We're the defending champion.
Well, we'll see for how much longer. Look, only one game separated those two teams. So there's going to be a interesting series starting the weekend if the Dodgers survive the Cardinals this upcoming week. So you can kind of tell when we're recording the show. But I do want to start with Alex. Classes have started. You're the one that's back in the classroom. How are you feeling? How are you doing? What are some observations from the classroom? Any feedback from the students?
Yes and yes. Well, it's been nice to be back in the classroom. It definitely feels more normal. Teaching on Zoom seemed very artificial, particularly for a class that's lab-based. Are you really need that experience and do stuff, active things. And so it's a nice transition. I think one of the things you also see that is very encouraging is that those social interactions that happen between the students that were probably the students were starved for, honestly. There seems to be a little bit of rust, social rust. Students don't seem quite as seamless in their transitions, interacting with one another, and just usual habitual stuff like putting backpacks away or just kind of getting organized in the physical space to get going for class. It seems a little bit clumsy, but overall, really, really good. Last week, you know, I heard a couple of things that. As an instructor, you always like to hear and overheard different groups of students say, this is already my favorite class. Granted, it's really early on one weekend. Now we're in the second week. I think the other thing that I've noticed, at least for myself, is just how much more I enjoy it. I see that increase in going from Zoom to in person. And just the infusion of that human element, the jokes, that humor, just things seem to be more fluid. I find myself making more eye contact than I used to before, and just my pacing for talking in the classroom seems a lot better. So that was just some quick notes. But
Alex, back in my day, they started the classes 10 minutes after the hour. Now they're starting it right off the hour. That's communism.
Now, why did they do that?
I'm not sure. I haven't really looked into it.
Just to be clear, instead of if your class is at 1 o'clock, it's at 1 o'clock instead of 1:10. And for most of the history of UCR, it started at 10 minutes after the hour. But can you tell the listeners what happens on the other side of the class?
I mean, on the other side of the.
But what I mean by that is that it actually ends 10 minutes early.
Correct. Oh, that's right. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't see what the big advantage was. It's something that was implemented. I think I remember being given a reason as to why we were switching, but I mean, I just put it out of sight.
I think it's because when administrators come to UCR, they come with a lot of baggage in the form of a template. And so if they came from an institution that started at 1 o'clock instead of 1:10, then they're going to think that's how it should be done. I don't know about this 10 minutes after nonsense. So everybody has their sense of how to do it. Right. Yeah. But it seems to be I don't know. I think the first way, the original way, was better. But everybody wants to make something new. Here's my innovation.
Hey, if you talk to my uncle who went to UCR in 1982, you know, there wasn't a class that started before 10 and no class started after 3. So that's not true. it's entirely possible that you had your schedule in the middle of the day. So,
it's entirely possible, in fact, guaranteed that he did. Classes that started, I remember back at 7:30. Some of them started early.
I just remember my coup de grace was one spring quarter. I managed to have all my classes on a Tuesday and a Thursday.
That's a good schedule because it's a 90-minute class and you get more done.
I had a 4-day weekend every week. So
that's not a bad deal.
That was good. But that was hard to do. I only achieved it once. So that was kind of what it was. So Alex, are you comfortable with that many people in the classroom? I mean,
I am,
you know, most people are vaccinated.
Pretty confident, comfortable.
Okay. I'm still having awkward interactions. People come a little too close to me. I'm like, I don't know. With that. So, all right.
Here's a really quick poll question. First of all, we're all vaccinated. I'm Moderna. What are you, Tony?
Pfizer. I got to get the booster.
And Alex, you are what?
Moderna as well.
Yeah. So did you see the report this week in the Los Angeles Times? It said the Moderna has the greatest endurance of immunity beyond Pfizer. It wasn't compared to J&J, but in trying to understand why that is, it looks like the Moderna dose is much larger than the Pfizer dose. So maybe that could be corrected just with a increased dosage. But is there any discussion in your class, Alex, about vaccination or about COVID at all? What are people saying or, you know, what are
not really. I mean, I think we most folks are adhering to the guidelines and everybody's wearing masks in the classroom. It was one of the requirements that we put on from the, and then we advised our teaching assistants and undergrad lab assistants that if for some reason some student did not wasn't wearing the mask properly or not wearing their mask, and they did not to feel forced to have to go and interact with them. And they could, you know, tell them that if they want to interact with them or get closer to provide any assistance, they can request that they put their mask on or just tell them, you know, I don't feel comfortable approaching you if you're not wearing your mask. So, and we'd back them up with that.
Wait a minute. So we do not have a mask mandate at UC Riverside. Is that what you're saying?
Well, we do. We're asked to wear masks on campus.
But you're saying you're told what to do in case someone doesn't. Is that correct?
Well, yes. Because the area of enforcement is a little hazy. I mean, just in full transparency. I mean, we could, as an instructor, you can ask somebody to leave your classroom.
I see.
Yeah, but none of the faculty really want to be the enforcers of a mask mandate for a variety of different reasons, right? So that is what has been the problem. Is like, well, who's going to be the person that has to enforce the mask mandate? And so obviously some faculty members will not. and others will, you know. I think for the most part, students have been fairly compliant with it, understanding that they want to keep the college and the college environment kind of going. I think it's actually going to be interesting after Thanksgiving because right now it's almost a closed pod, right? Students generally interact with other students and with the campus environment, which we know is very safe given the vaccination mandate that the university has. But what implication does it have when all these students start traveling, visiting family, and coming back to campus? That's going to be some interesting time to kind of take a look at. So we'll see. But you know, from all anecdotes, right? I think the non-pharmaceutical interventions, the masking, the distancing, has been fairly effective so far. So, but I think everybody's busy trying to keep that going, as well. So I'm happy for you, Alex. You're back in the classroom. I'm sure the students are happy. What's incredible is half the student body has never been to the campus or any campus, and now they're back in person. So talk about a lot of change, a lot of learning, I think, on campus environments. But speaking of the big news story the last couple of days, I wanted to talk a little bit about Facebook. a lot, and we have multiple ways of discussing Facebook. We have the congressional hearings that are happening with the Facebook whistleblower. We also have the fact that Facebook was down for about 5-6 hours the other day, which was an interesting story in of itself. And then we have the larger sort of existential issue about the social networking and platforms. So maybe I want to get your thoughts, Clark, and then Alex. You know, what did you guys do without Facebook for about 5 hours?
I read about why Facebook was down. It was really interesting stuff because it really looked like internal sabotage because it was so comprehensive, so thorough. There was even a disc even the ownership of the Facebook domain name was turned back to Network Solutions, and it was for sale. So that, how the hell did that happen? And so this, and the explanation Facebook gave, which had something to do with the servers were being redone or something, it just seemed odd. Also, the integration of everything within the Facebook digital architecture is such that the doors to the server rooms were all locked. And so I assume that the solution was in the server room, and because the doors were locked, they had to drill them out. And so this is happening at the very same time. Well, actually, that was the day before the Facebook whistleblower was scheduled to testify before the Senate. And the day after, she appeared on 60 Minutes. And her indictment of Facebook, I would say, is very serious. And it's very well presented and very compelling. And I think it's convincing.
Right. I want to get into that. But Alex, what did you do for the 5 hours without Facebook? As a man who actually uses the platform probably more than Clark and I.
I was teaching. So, I mean, I was in the classroom and pretty much most of the outage. And then I was heading to L.A. to watch a panel session for the Fernando Mania specialist coming out. So.
Oh, well, okay. You were blissfully ignorant at the time.
Well, I was aware that it was down because I check it on occasion between steps, but you know, I did not have time to really focus or dig in. I remember
texting Clark and then texting some other friends, just making wildly. Speculative rumors and assessments. It was like, it had to be an inside job. It was at the strategic vulnerability point. And Clark, you had mentioned it earlier. It wasn't that the guys were locked out of the server room. Apparently the individuals, if I was reading Krebs on Security correctly, by Brian Krebs, I recommend people follow that blog. It's actually a very good blog on internet and data security. But the guys who had keys to the server room could get into the server room. But okay. Those were not the individuals who knew how to fix the routers and the servers in order to be able to turn back the hardware. The result of them using this new back-ended software that they had updated locked out the guys who could fix it, right? But also locked out the guys who could get into it at the same time. So they were backed up on both ends and couldn't get into the room. That's why it took 6 hours. And part of the explanation that Facebook put out was that this was unprecedented because they had very low staffing levels in Menlo Park, partly because of the pandemic. And I'm like, where is your freaking engineer commuting from, you know, coming in to try and fix it? Clearly, you did not have enough staff on site to fix the update, but apparently it was a back end update that created all the damage. I'm just gonna say that's very reckless coding. I've only witnessed this level of impact a few times in my professional career, and it's usually rectified within an hour. But this was pretty bad. You know, because you stopped. What am I gonna say about 4 billion users? I mean, it was a near total failure. Of what happened within the infrastructure. And so we were talking about, it's actually, some people have said it is the worst service interruption on an online internet platform in the last decade.
I think the scale of it has just been enormous.
I mean, it's unprecedented in scale, right? Because we're talking billions of users were locked out for that. And so I think it was definitely very challenging. For them to kind of go over that. But and I think Mark Zuckerberg, during the entire time the stock is getting hammered, lost $7 billion worth of Facebook net valuation, which had come back today.
It looked like it was just 20% down.
Yeah. Because of that. But it's one of those, well, it was really deeply affecting to the company. And it's hard not to see it in the light of and again, this is a perfect example. As I said, it was reckless speculation that you and I engaged in, Clark and Alex. You know this. Reckless speculation is what human beings, absent information and critical thinking, will engage in, and that's what we said.
It's only reckless if you publicize it. It was
perfect. Well, we just did.
Well, you publicized
it. Yeah, but. But there was speculation, and remember we had that Pandora papers the day before.
Let me just say that the excuse that Facebook has given is an excuse that is in their interest, because that kind of failure is much more palatable to people than sabotage. Mm. That's what it, I mean, it really did look that way. It was so major. And the timing was so apropos to the critics of Facebook. So it's not reckless. It's I think, actually reasonable speculation. But it's not something you say, I absolutely believe. And I thought it was a very appropriate and reasonable speculation.
Right. And I think it's I thought it was reasonable at the time, given that the congressional testimony was today and it went down yesterday, right? So I think it's coincidences are rare. They do happen. But we do not have definitive information otherwise of what's gone on. But speaking about the Facebook testimony, did you guys happen to catch any of it today at all? Okay, Alex is shaking his whole head.
Yes. And that it was harmful to children. And that.
Well, it goes further. I thought you would have led off with the.
That they were limiting, definitely further, that they were limiting some things prior to the election. When the election was over, they said, let's increase let the conflict rage again, let the disinformation rage, because it makes them money. It's eyes on stuff. You know, anger and rage. This is actually the secret to Fox News. They make people angry, and it becomes an adrenaline addiction. And it makes people engaged. And so that's what they're doing. And they're not concerned about truth. They're apparently not concerned about the consequences to our democracy, and they let it all happen. In fact, they were a major source of communication for January 6th. And you mentioned Krebs on security. I believe he's investigating the role of bots and just surrogate Facebook postings related to January 6th. So that's an interesting speculation. I think he must know something.
Right. And Brian Krebs was the Washington Post reporter from 1999 to 2009, who's been working on these stories for a long time, covering a lot of the technologies sector, particularly from 21.
It's a really important thing that has all kinds of, it's stuff that happens in the digital world, and you think, well, it's just digital. It's kind of like imaginary, but no, it becomes kinetic. It becomes kinetic in the form of January 6th. It changes. It was, I think, a big factor in the election of Donald Trump. It was, and there was Cambridge Analytica. And also, there's a report today in the New York Times that the United States has intelligence assets around the world. And for some reason, they're being assassinated all over the place. So that tells me that something has been hacked.
Very likely. It is not impossible that, particularly, I think, during the last administration,
yes,
where they were not focused on cybersecurity.
Well, and also they'll sell anything.
Right. And so I think there is, I think we're only getting back in the saddle but we're behind. You know, it's 4 years behind in cyber security and cyber defense. So I think that's something that's very huge when we're talking about it. But the I really wanted to get into some of the statements that Francis Haugen, which is the whistleblower, had kind of come out. She worked on their civic misinformation team for about 2 years until this last May. And, you know, she told a lot about how it is virtually impossible to stop misinformation on Facebook. And she made the accusation that the company's leadership knows how to make the changes, but they won't do it because it will cost them money. I'm personally not surprised. I mean, this was, you know, Facebook, if you are to believe, you know, the movie The Social Network, but even in his documented history, the first app that Mark Zuckerberg created at Harvard, right, was You're Hot or Not. You know, it was a voting app to kind of see how attractive you were. I remember that coming out, and I'm sitting there going like, so what? You think this guy now who has billions of dollars and has a social network company has somehow reformed? He's the same guy that would create an app of doing something so baseless as the rating who's physically more attractive than something else and come up with an application, which I might add, Harvard did ban. You know, but the notion is that, and I wanted to say this, I'm surprised, Clark, you didn't bring it up. She pointed out that this is a danger to national security, that the misinformation, particularly that spread on Facebook, is really, really dangerous and sinister to our society. And we're seeing the effects of that with the coronavirus right now, the rise of the right, et cetera, et cetera. Because I get algorithms. I don't know about you, Alex. Do you get any like weird ads from like the far right on your algorithms or anything like that on occasion? I mean, I do.
Not really. Or I just ignore them. I mean, I just see right past them and be like, whatever.
Yeah.
But no, I think I don't. Maybe because of my networks on social media are all very liberal. A majority of my friends are on the liberal side. I know that probably changes the gaming and the algorithms, plus the type of posts that I put out. So I really don't see much of
that. I think you should put in some terminology occasionally and just search for some alt-right stuff like I do for research purposes, and it comes out. And like, I get ads for days that come out after I search for like, you know, alt-right, or I search for like, you know, MAGA or something, and it's just interesting.
I do notice all the ads you get for mentioning stuff in your conversations, because they're
right.
Still listening. So you mention a certain product, and before you know it, you see it displayed. Or if you click on something or buy something on Facebook, or through an ad you see on Facebook, and you get bombarded by the same website over and over again for days to follow. So.
Right, and the algorithms just keep bombarding you for it. I tend to agree. It is a problem with national security with it. Clark, I think you have mentioned that you don't ever see any of that stuff on Facebook.
No, well, like Alex, my predilections are all on the left. And even though, you know, I actually do know people who disparage me and say things like, "He says he's on the left, and look, he's really like Donald Trump," or something like that. That's not true. That's insane. But, you know, if you're there is an extreme version of everything. And the thing is, I see much more extreme right than I see right or moderate. Extreme right is really what they're pushing hard everywhere. It's that's what Fox News or Fox propaganda is, what more people are saying now, the Fox propaganda channel. But the also, I guess, Facebook is, for a lot of people who are probably in the middle, it is an amplifier of extremism. And so it's channeling you into more and more, for a lot of people, more and more extreme content. And that one of the aspects of that, of extreme content, is that it's intended to produce anger, which is addictive, apparently, psychologically. And it certainly seems to act that way. So that's a big factor of why we are where we are.
Well, and it's not just Facebook. I mean, it's one of the elements of it, but there's WhatsApp and there's Instagram. And Instagram, I think, was brought up, and I think it was, you know, it was actually fairly dangerous in this one example. You know, and this is a report from MSNBC. Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut's office, in preparation for the meeting, they did a little bit of research. They set up a profile, an Instagram account, to pose as a 13-year-old girl to research what the app is like for teens. And now I'm reading from the article. Our research has shown in real time Instagram's recommendations will still latch onto a person's insecurities, a young woman's vulnerabilities about their bodies, and drag them into dark places that glorify eating disorders and self-harm. They go on later to note in the article that within a day of actually notice of sort of posting an Instagram photo and then using keywords like I feel fat and like, you know, and some of these keywords that they have used. I won't repeat them here, but they use these keywords. Within a day, they were sent sites that promoted these eating disorders, that that encouraged women with self-esteem and confidence issues to engage in self-harm and in behaviors that are detrimental and psychologically damaging. So it's not a small thing with that. And there's a curious rise here. If you take a look at it, there's an article in here from the journal Nature from February 2020 by Jonathan Haidt and Nick Allen. It's called Scrutinizing the Effects of Digital Technology on Mental Health. They took a look at the impact of teenagers, the percentage of U.S. teenagers who have experienced major depression within the last year. And this study goes from 2004 to 2018. There's an increase from about 13% of girls experiencing major depression in about 2010, 2012. To nearly 23%. So we see a 10 percentage increase, nearly a doubling of that for girls between 2012 and 2018. And you see an uptick in boys from about 5% to about 7% as well. So there are some huge rates of increases, even though it's grown more higher for girls than it is for boys. But what happened in 2012 was the explosion of both Facebook and Instagram. And certainly social media, for all its good, has come along with magnifying some of society's evils and some of society's problems, I think. And so you can take a look at that journal article. Correlation is not causation, but I think there's a very strong line that can be drawn in with the research here. The best thing you can do is, for mental health at some level, is to turn off social networking, actually engage in actual social networking physically with people in person in some ways. What do you guys think about that? I mean, the harm that particularly it does to adolescents and young people.
This is something I have no expertise in, but I have seen how a lot of people, and it's not just young women, but people in general, get into expectations about what their body should look like based on photos of models who professionally shaped their body to look that way. And then even more than that can be, and probably are, photoshopped. So these are very unrealistic, I'm not even going to say idealizations, but, you know, outright fantasies as to how people are presented to in a way to look, to be modeled after. So when someone compares themselves to one of these fantasy idealization, non-realistic paradigm images, they are inevitably going to come up short. And so I think particularly if they're immature and don't have a sense of perspective and don't have a sense of being comfortable in their body, which is really important, I think, for someone to have as a psychological just sense of comfort with who they are and how they look. And actually other people find that attractive in my experience. So, but if they don't have that, I think the cognitive dissonance between the expectation as to what they think they should look like in order to be socially prized, mm-hmm. and what they actually look like is such that they can become profoundly depressed to the point where some people try to harm themselves. Maybe some try to starve themselves. Some try to get maybe plastic surgery that would be very unhealthy and you know, I've heard about storefront procedures that ended in mutilation and even death. Is it really Instagram or is it popular media? Because before Instagram, all those pictures were in magazines and they were in maybe broadcast media. Certainly since the dawn of Hollywood, beautiful people have been selected by not so beautiful directors and producers to be in movies. And the reason that that happened was because audiences like to look at them.
Well, I think a more legitimate concern, and this is the one I would bring up, is the case of what Senator Blumenthal's staff did, which is it's not so much that these things aren't out there. I think that they already are. There's some predisposition to it. And then I want to get Alex's thought on this, but the real problem is the intensification, because the ability of AI, the ability of the social network to intensify the impact of these images, to intensify and reinforce these type of behaviors, where all of a sudden you're being bombarded with images and resources to continue your self-harm, to continue the poor behavior, because you keep going down that path, right? Another great example, and we've all seen it, is the if you want to go to an anti-vax ad, it's only about two or three clicks removed from legitimate vaccine information right now, right? And that's the thing, is sort of like being able to consume this, and then you're able to kind of just constantly sort of consume the media without pause, without any mechanism to critically analyze it, I think is very dangerous, because it's like opening up a fire hose on you. So, I don't know. Alex, have you experienced the fire hose of disinformation?
I don't know that I've experienced it. I've seen it.
Yeah.
But it is. It's not a trivial matter. I mean, this is very serious. And I think, as often happens with technology, it outpaces, in a lot of cases, the research behind it and the consequences it's going to So a lot of things get pushed and become really popular. And before you know it, you see the harmful effects of it. With teenagers in particular, as malleable and impressionable as they are, it's really easy to kind of exacerbate a lot of these insecurities and misconceptions. But I mean, it's not just children and teenagers. I mean, adults are swayed by these one shape or another algorithms that end up putting a lot of information that reinforces some of their notions or some of their convictions. So it creates like this echo chamber where people just keep going down that rabbit hole.
Right. And they never come out. I mean, it's its own, you know, when I kind of find myself going back to my interview with Stephen Hassan, right? I mean, it's like your information is being controlled, but it's not being controlled by an individual now. It's being controlled by an algorithm that keeps you in an echo chamber of your own choosing, which is what's kind of ironic and difficult about this. I think that's the heart of the existential crisis within Facebook, is what responsibility does this company and corporation have to fight disinformation, limit disinformation, and serve the public good? Or is it all just like, you know, about the ratings? I mean, let's be honest. If I'm really craving Alex Jones for all the harm he's doing, he's making his money selling supplements. You know, he wants to make his money, and his way is to be crazy and then sell the supplements to enhance your male virility. Right. And as if you need virility pills if you're Alex Jones's like listeners. Well, maybe you do. I don't know.
I'm sure they do.
but you know, I mean, it's sort of the crassness of which, you know, we're here trying to get to get money over a public good. I think it's just is interesting. More interesting, I think, as we're talking about this, it's Facebook's response. They're not lying. They're not denying the fact that this is happening. They're just saying that we don't have any incentive to do it. And the way that they attack the, Clark, you had some interesting views about how they're attacking, the whistleblower, Francis Haugen.
Well,
I mean, they're not denying the facts that she's been playing.
They crafted a statement that actually, I think, did call her credentials into question in the best way that they could do it, which was actually honest. And that is to say that instead of being there 10 years, she was there only 2 years. Instead of saying that she was in demeaning her in any ethical or intellectual way, they said that she was there. She did not have what I think they said was C-level access, which is, I guess, a leadership level at Facebook.
Yeah, she couldn't talk to Zuckerberg or Sheryl Sandberg, right?
Yeah, but she did have access to all those documents, which had all the information that she's talking about in them. And that's so I think ultimately she's a very credible, a very powerful and very, very significant and important witness. So I'm not praising Facebook for attacking her, but they, I think, put her somewhat in perspective in order to judge her credibility. But I think it turns out that she's completely honest. She's divulged everything. She's not said that she was anything other than she was. It's the documents that speak for themselves. So yeah, I think it's going to have a real impact.
Well, and I think this is the interesting thing. I think we think of Facebook, I think, in a hyper local context, immediately with our immediate social circle, right? And how it's being used by our friends and family, and maybe even in the nation. But what I found more disturbing in her testimony today was that how dangerous it was for democracy, but what it was extremely dangerous for our national security. Part of her testimony today, literally, she noted that this Facebook's engagement-based ranking system is literally fanning ethnic violence, end quote, in places like Ethiopia. And we forget that, you know, there are billions of users of Facebook around the world who are not only using the platform here in the United States for their political positions. I mean, we already mentioned, we've discussed at length January 6th, but that's being repeated constantly, right, Clark? It's being repeated not just in the United States. Well, I mean, they certainly would like to repeat it in the United States, but they're using it actively to commit ethnic genocide in places like in Ethiopia and who knows where else. These sort of algorithms and these protocols to try and induce that type of behavior, you know. And so, you know, what are some of your thoughts on that, Alex? I mean, just being the global citizen you are, like, it like, if we think, oh wow, these are dirty in the American context, you know, how about globally?
Yeah, I mean, it's again, I always think of that quote from Jurassic Park as a paraphrasing here, but it's sort of you think of inventing new technologies or new things and just because you can, but don't necessarily think of the consequences. And yeah, I mean, it's just a new way to, like any tool, it can be misused. And in many cases, it is being misused. I think the circumstances and the effect, the gravity, depends on the context in which these strategies are employed. In places where, in a less free society, I think that you even take these sort of the bad behind these algorithms or behind these using these nefarious purposes, and it just heightens the impact they may have. So it's like arming a sociopath, essentially. I mean, a tool can be a weapon in somebody's hand, right?
Right. And I think, and the line that you're quoting is from Jeff Goldblum's character, mm-hmm. Dr. Malcolm in Jurassic Park. But the line is, yeah, but your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, that they didn't stop to think if they should. Mm-hmm. And I think that sums up Mark Zuckerberg's approach with Facebook. Just because you could, should you? Right. Like, I don't think people think about the ethics of that. I mean, that's why I think a field that you've been kind of participating in, Alex, is really important. Bioethics, technology ethics. We need more ethics classes. We need more sort of humanities thinking about these sort of things than rather than just rushing off and sort of saying, well, that's good. We can do it.
Right. I mean, it's cross disciplinarity. I mean, we had an example a couple of years ago where scientists in China decided to use CRISPR to engineer a baby. I mean, again, just because you can doesn't mean you should automatically. Think of the ramifications of it. I mean, eugenics was not too long ago. I mean, it's still.
Yeah, you could use CRISPR for eugenic ends, right? As much as it is to restore someone's sight. I mean, that was the new breaking news this last week, when someone used CRISPR to manufacture proteins for someone in their eyes, right, so they could actually see. So, I mean, it's just, you know, this is definitely something that we need to think our way through. And I have, this is a personal bias. This is a Dr. T moment when students ask me, Dr. T, what's the biggest issue facing the 21st century, what students and people really need to do, is I think we have a really hard time right now stopping and thinking, being able to filter the news and having critical thinking, right? That is the hardest thing to do right now because there's so much information, right? It's just a fire hose of information. And these algorithms are trained to incite us to get that cheap dopamine either from fear or anger. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to turn that off and to train oneself to wait, let me think about this critically. Is this really happening? What's the context of everything?
Even a well functioning adult, I mean, now I consider myself mostly a functional adult. I can easily get caught up on just these pressures that you encounter just from having a social media presence. It is addictive. You do sometimes think of the likes and who likes it and who doesn't, and you, to the point that you might start second guessing as to why, you know. Especially if you're at a moment where you're feeling unwell and just vulnerable in some way, it's really easy to slip down a rabbit hole. I mean, we're emotional beings, and we're not immune to the pressures that can exist or can be created, whether they're real or perceived, from these tools.
Clark, I want to get your thoughts. You seem to be a man who is much more immune to the effects of social media than probably Alex and myself.
I don't know that's true, but I think really, really critically about pretty much everything. And I don't I don't. Here's what I'm thinking about Facebook. I think we've got to quantify what's wrong. What are the crimes at Facebook? Because really, all of us have used Facebook for the simple sell of Facebook, which is that it is a means by which you can keep in touch with people who are your friends and your family, and you can communicate and share pictures of kids and your anniversary and your birthday party and all of that stuff that actually connects you in a better way to them than you would otherwise be. So I think we can look, this is the bright side of Facebook. It's a tool to keep in touch with friends and family, and it works. Mm-hmm. It actually works. And then you can also keep in touch with colleagues, and you can share things that have to do with your work or with your academic pursuits. And so it can become you can create a world around you that's appropriate and that's of your interest and so on. But here's where the darkness is, that because you share so much information with Facebook, you're giving them a constellation of data that paints a picture as to who you are, where your inclinations are, what your sexuality is, what your politics are, what are your feelings even about religion and life and death. And all of that stuff was sold to a company called Cambridge Analytica. And they used that information plus artificial intelligence to pointillistically target individuals with the kind of advertising that would sell them on Donald Trump. That's what Cambridge Analytica, which was set up by Steve Bannon and others, was used to do. And what this was a mutation and a perversion of the means by which Facebook was going to monetize itself. And that is to understand your predilections and your professions in order to sell you things. But with Cambridge Analytica, and by the way, this was the first time I saw the incredible capacity for evil. If this was a tool in the hands of a tyrant, the power to fester and a healthy democracy into a tyranny exists through Facebook.
Well, Clark, I want to say, are you sure it's not already in the hands of a tyrant, given Facebook's lack of security protocols of selling the information?
I am sure that it is not. However, the capacity for ill was demonstrated by Cambridge Analytica, and that, as I said, was a perversion of the paradigm, which is how they sell, how they monetize it, how they make money by selling things to people who in the course of conversation say something like, you know, I really would like a new leather sofa. And then interestingly, there's some information about leather sofas that just comes up. And while that's convenient, I'm sure we've all had the experience of like, I was just talking about Johnny Cash the other day, and here's all this Johnny Cash stuff.
I just want you to know you're a Democrat if you like Hondas. Because apparently this is the number one car of Democrats.
Well, and Toyota is really pushing for Republicans.
The Japanese win either way, right?
You know what? Yeah, I mean, I can't.
As owner of a Toyota, Alex.
I was driving behind a Tacoma earlier today, and they were definitely very right leaning and very, their back window was plastered with very conservative decals and offensive commentary that I won't repeat.
The problem is that it used to be when Republicans were actually patriots, instead of like saying they were patriots, that buying a non-made in America car would be something they wouldn't do. But I mean, they're just going for whatever is cheapest and whatever is like most reliable. I mean, the basic parameters by which you.
Right. Well, you know, the so-called patriot type, I'm talking about the ones in insurgents in the Capitol of January 6th.
Well, actually,
and they're also for
the most traitorous patriots you could possibly find. Right.
I mean, they're walking contradiction. I mean, they're for blue lives, yet they attack police. I mean,
it is interesting, but the contradiction, right, is okay because it's reinforced by social media, and I think that's where the danger really lies. We're running out of time here, so I want to get to our one good thing. So it is how typically we end. But mine is actually a melancholic one good thing, because one of my favorite character actors, Willie Garson, passed this week. He was most famously in Sex and the City. I think that's the role that he was. Stanford was the role that he was most famous in. But I miss him from my sci-fi movies, whether it's Stargate SG-1. See, my nerd factor is very high. I'm watching Stargate SG-1 and a bunch of other sort of fringe sci-fi movies, but that's a little bit melancholic. So I encourage people to watch some of that work. He's very funny in all of it and plays those characters really, really well. And he sadly passed from pancreatic cancer. So that's my one good thing for this week is the memory of Willie Garson, the character actor. So, Alex or Clark?
I guess I'll go first. I mean, just, my good thing is just having, focusing on self-care, you know, taking the time to, really, allow yourself to be loved and love yourself, be patient with yourself. So that's my takeaway of the week as a positive, and just, you know, to share with the listeners. So
we have a minute left for you, Clark.
The film on HBO, The Many Saints of Newark,
Tony Soprano.
Yeah, it's done by David Chase, and it's at the highest level of quality. If you like The Sopranos, and I did, this is something you'll enjoy. And I just can't help but to notice that Donald Trump really fits into the mafia paradigm. I don't even think he's an overboss. He's not a boss, capo di tutti capa. He is an underboss. And but anyway, the drama, it's so well done, so creative. David Chase, a great director, and a very worthy film, The Many Saints of Newark.
Well, for Alex Cortez and Clark Price, I'm your host, Tony Yang. Tune in next time for more of the Happy Hour. I want to thank you for listening. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.